The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the News and Observer and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, and as we need to remind you frequently, neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, our journey will take us to some unusual points of interest. First up, we're going to take a look at how major airports are looking at you when you travel. Now, recently, I had the pleasure of visiting Walt Disney World in Florida with my grandchildren, and while enjoying some of the rides, I was surprised on several occasions to see my face displayed on screens that were accompanying some of these rides. Now, these images were taken by cameras that I did not see readily or were hidden somewhere, and so they took pictures of what our faces looked like at the thrill of the moment, so to speak. Now, at the same time, it gave me pause to realize the kind of technology we now have available to capture us, so to speak, at any given moment, at any given place. Well, keep this in mind as we began reading this article. Facial recognition will transform airport security checkpoints. This is written by Sheldon J. Jacobson of the Chicago Tribune. His article appeared in the January 15, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. Let's see what Sheldon has to tell us. Imagine using technology that never forgets a face while improving airport security and shortening lines. Such technology exists and may be coming to an airport near you. Every flyer over the past two decades knows that airport security procedures involve a lot of unpacking, screening, and repacking. This is the price that must be paid for using commercial air travel. Yet it does not need to be this way, and the Transportation Security Administration has the right idea in testing and deploying biometrics such as facial identification technology at airport security checkpoints. Although travelers believe that the most important task undertaken by the TSA is detecting threat items, the true role of airport security screening is ensuring that you are the person you claim to be. The TSA has been working on moving more passengers from unknown to known status for more than a decade. The first effort in this regard was the introduction of TSA PreCheck in 2011, which gives travelers the privilege for a fee of accessing expedited screening lanes. This means that your shoes can stay on, your computers and electronics can stay in your carry-on bag, and light outerwear can remain in place. The launch of facial identification technology enhances such efforts and has the potential to revolutionize the way that airport security checkpoints are designed and operated. Facial identification technology ensures that you are who you claim to be. When presenting yourself at a checkpoint, your face becomes your entry pass, based on a repository of pictures that you have voluntarily provided in the past. These pictures are assembled from passports or visas. Another technology the TSA has deployed to enhance identity verification is credential authentication technology. Now, this, in concert with real IDs, which regrettably have been delayed until 2025, as a requirement for air travel, provide a more robust process for identity verification. Facial identification technology takes this process to an even higher level of robustness. It is now being tested on a limited scale at 16 airports. Passengers are being given the opportunity to participate by opting in at these locations. After more than two decades in a post-9/11 world, most travelers believe that airport screening is about stopping threats from getting onto airplanes. In reality, the focus on detection is a surrogate for stopping bad people from inflicting harm on the air system. By elevating identity validation, the need for threat item detection is reduced. Once a person's identity is confirmed using facial recognition or identification technology, they may be subjected to expedited screening, much like those who have been vetted by TSA PreCheck. As more people opt into the facial identification program, the aggregate air system risk is reduced. The biggest criticism of facial recognition technology is the perceived invasion of privacy and the security of photos taken at checkpoints. Yet the photos being used to match your identity, like when applying for a passport or participating in the Global Entry Program, are those that have already been shared with Customs and Border Protection. New photos taken at airport security checkpoints do nothing more than supplement what has been freely provided. As for the security of such photo data, the cyber world has been and continues to be the Wild West for criminals. Much of what we do on our phones may be more vulnerable to intrusion than the photos stored by the Department of Homeland Security. The long game for facial identification technology is screening in real time. This means that most travelers can pass through checkpoints without stopping, with none of their personal items requiring screening. This futuristic vision for airport security is a far cry from the physical screening-centered approach travelers endure today. Facial identification technology is a driver to make this future a reality. Such changes will not happen overnight. It will take many years before facial identification technology is sufficiently robust to effect such massive changes. However, the technology is a game changer. It adds a layer of security that will revolutionize airport screening. Once implemented and perfected, it will create a pathway for an airport screening experience that will eventually be embraced as the new model for airport security. So, things to come. And I will say, in recent purchases from technology, a new laptop and also a new cell phone, facial recognition was one of the options I had for security. And so, it's there and growing and continues to evolve. Well, let's move on to some more exotic places of interest. Scientists inch closer to learning origins of mysterious fairy circles come under this topic. Now, this one appeared in the January 14, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. It's written by Kasia Patel of the Washington Post, and the photo caption will provide some background as we head to southwestern Africa along the coast of Namibia. And it says, some researchers see these spatial patterns, this is a picture of vegetation, as a vegetative adaption for coping with hotter, drier environments, which are ever increasing under climate change, and they create these little circular patterns. Let's see what Kasia Patel is going to tell us. The origins of eerily perfect circles in the eastern Namib Desert have puzzled scientists for decades. The circles, seen as patches of bare soil on otherwise arid and grassy terrain, appear equidistant to one another as if somebody methodically took a cookie cutter to the ground. Satellite imagery shows there could be millions of these fairy circles in the area, but scientists have debated what could explain the existence of even one, which can span up to 20 meters in diameter. Perhaps termites are chomping at the plant roots, maybe the grasses are somehow creating the patterns, or a toxin has decimated the soil. Or maybe aliens are sizing up the desert as a potential landing spot, and then he offers in parentheses, spoiler, it's never aliens. There must be very strong ordering forces behind the creation of these patterns, because otherwise it would be much more noisy, much less order, said Stephen Getson, who is a desert ecologist at the University of Göttingen and has published numerous papers on these circles. That's the fascination about the fairy circles, he says. Now, Getson and his colleagues have acquired new compelling evidence to explain the mysterious circles in the region. They point to a fierce competition among plants for water on the arid terrain. Researchers say periodic vegetation patterns like fairy circles could also increasingly pop up around the world under a warming climate. Simply put, plants may be battling one another to survive the dry conditions, stealing water away from their neighbors, which leaves a bare circle. Now, Getson first saw these mystery circles in person when he was studying at the University of Namibia more than 20 years ago. His published his initial study on the topic in 2000, in which he named the phenomenon fairy circles because of its vague similarity of fairy rings of mushrooms often seen in forests. And you can see these actually as you walk through parks today. The two are not related except in name, and neither were created by fairies, by the way. That's also in parentheses. The Namibian fairy circles are unusual not only in their appearance but also location. They manifest in one of the driest areas in the world, occurring in a very narrow sliver that receives only 70 to 120 millimeters of annual rainfall. Move just 30 kilometers to the east, where annual rainfall is around 150 millimeters. There, Getson says, no fairy circles are in sight and grass coverage is continuous. Now, this is a very strong indication that this is a water-driven or climatically-driven phenomenon, Getson said. The fairy circles are basically an expression that there is not enough moisture to sustain continuous vegetation cover. The grasses organize themselves just to harvest that limited water in the most optimal way. Over the past 3 years, Getson and his team gathered field data in Namibia to explore this hypothesis. The team installed sensors to measure water content in the soil and excavated grass. After a rain event, they found that grass grew inside and outside the fairy circle. Within a few weeks, however, the grass inside the circle died while the plants on the periphery persisted. They also found that the soil moisture in the top few inches inside the circle decreased despite the fact that there was no grass present. Getson explained that the plants on the circle's periphery were out-competing the grass inside the circle for water. The team even found that these periphery plants have longer roots, allowing them to laterally siphon water better. As a result, there's not enough water left inside the circle for grass to grow. But why are the plants arranged around a circle? Well, the shape of a circle allows individual grasses to maximize their water availability, Getson said. A circle, which has a small circumference to area ratio, limits the number of surrounding plants and boosts the amount of water available to those plants, whereas in a square, more plants would have to share the same amount of water. From the competition point of view, this is the most logical structure to access these limited resources of water, Getson said. Getson acknowledges that plants don't have brains per se, but this is an intelligent mathematical pattern. Several of the circles are also evenly spaced from one another to create a uniformly repeated honeycomb pattern, part of its eerie appearance. Researchers call this uniform design a Turing pattern, that's spelled T-U-R-I-N-G, which was first explained by mathematician Alan Turing. It's not only animals which act as ecosystem engineers, plants are doing the same thing, Getson said. There's increasing awareness that plants may be more intelligent than we believe. Outside of Namibia, fairy circles have also been found in the Australian desert. Getson and his team traveled to Australia and determined the circles were also formed through plant competition and self-organization. Some researchers see these spatial patterns as a potential tool for coping with hotter, drier environments, which are ever increasing under climate change. People are talking and tipping points, or rather about tipping points, as you say, approaching a point where a system collapses, says Ehud Maron, a physicist at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel, who has published papers with Getson. There are many alternative pathways of response, he adds. Some of them are resilient. Maron and his colleagues are studying how threatened ecosystems can survive through the formation of spatial patterns. His research shows that vegetation will rearrange and self-organize in response to how dry the environment is. A well-hydrated environment may have uniform vegetation, but vegetation becomes patchier as precipitation decreases to maximum water availability or maximize water availability for competitive plants. Uniform vegetation can transform into gap patterns like the fairy circles. So gap patterns can morph into stripes of vegetation in even drier climates. When rainfall further decreases, the stripes can form into spots. And that gives you some idea of why you see certain patterns when you're out hiking in the woods, maybe, or see things along parkways and greenways and so forth. Well, not everyone is on board with Getson's explanation. Australian ecologist Fiona Walsh and her colleagues assert the fairy circles in Australia were created by termites. Yet Getson said he did not find compelling termite evidence in his samples in either Australia or Namibia. Marion Meyer, a fellow fairy circle researcher, does not believe termites or ants are the cause of the Namibian fairy circles, but still finds Getson's explanation unconvincing. He proposes another theory. A toxic plant called Euphorbia, once grew where the fairy circles are now, and killed beneficial microbes which help grasses survive in the desert. He said the plant's toxic latex also prevented the soil from absorbing the water, explaining the lack of water near the circle's surface. Getson has also published literature countering Myers' microbe theory, but Myers said that in science, it's good to disagree and wonder. The fairy circles, it's very difficult to prove conclusively, said Meyer, a plant chemist at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. I think many years later, a scientist will provide more evidence. Then eventually, the correct theory will be accepted, but at the moment, it's still open. So if you see those strange patterns on walks and things, well, it gives you some idea of what scientists are looking at, and you can talk about it as far as your travels go, right? All right, well, let's see. It's back to the United States of America for our next location. This is the City of Brotherly Love, Philadelphia. No doubt this historic site offers many choices for travel, but there is some new, something new taking place that might prove intriguing to you. Writer Kathy Free is going to tell us about Mike Dank. He and a friend founded PhilTel. Now, this is a telephone collective that converts old donated payphones into free working phones using coinless circuit boards rewired to connect to the Internet. So let's go see what this is all about. This was written initially as a special to the Washington Post. A visit to Iffy Books in Philadelphia might feel like wandering through a time portal, and attached to the wall outside the store entrance, shoppers will find a shiny silver and black oblong box with a coin slot, a working payphone, but in this case, no quarters are required. Any call to the United States will be free. And by the way, I need to add that this article appeared in the online edition of the News and Observer on January 13th of this year. Now we go to a quote. I was talking to one guy in his 20s about it, and when I showed him my payphone, he had no idea what he was looking at, said Mike Dank, age 31. It was like an alien had delivered it from outer space. Dank, a technical engineer from Springfield, Pennsylvania, about 30 miles from Philly, has loved payphones since he was a teenager. 15 years ago, he picked up one for $20 at a flea market and stored it in a corner of his parents' basement. Payphones are nostalgic to me. I used one to call my parents to come pick me up when I was in high school, he said. After I bought one, I thought, I'm going to do something with this phone one day and maybe install it as my house phone. When he bought his first cell phone as a high school senior in 2008, Dank soon gave up on that idea. Then a few years ago, he heard about a group called PhilTel that had installed about 10 public payphones around Portland, Oregon that could be used by anyone free of charge. The phones worked through broadband internet connections, and there was no charge to make calls anywhere in North America. It was just a really cool idea, and I wondered if I could do something similar in Philadelphia, Dank said. There are lots of people who can't afford a cell phone or a phone bill. Homeless people, low-income families, and anyone who just doesn't want the hassle of owning a cell phone would all benefit, he said. Payphones have unfortunately been pretty much phased out. We only have about 50 still working in Philadelphia, Dank said. I thought it would be great to bring them back, he said. He and a friend, Naveen Albert, decided in June to start PhilTel, a phone collective that would convert old donated payphones into free working phones using coinless circuit boards rewired to connect through the Internet. They're now looking for people to donate payphones, phone booths, telephone cable, routers, and payphone parts such as handsets and keypads so they can rewire and install public phones in neighborhoods throughout Philadelphia. For their first project, Dank hauled his collectible 60-pound payphone from his parents' basement. He then convinced Steve McLaughlin, the owner of Iffy's Books, to let him install the first PhilTel phone outside his shop near Chinatown in Philly. Mike's a good customer and has been coming to the store since we opened, says McLaughlin, 37. I'm always looking for creative ideas to shift our culture, and a free payphone is a great example of shared resources. I was all in. He and McLaughlin held an installation party at the bookstore and introduced people to the quirky joys of using a free payphone. Lots of younger people today have never used one, Dank said. They might walk past one and not even notice they were looking at a payphone. They seem irrelevant, but I'm hoping to change that. Some people are surprised he wants to bring back the retro phones, but Dank said he's not alone in his enthusiasm. He points to a Google Map site that tracks payphones that have been reported to still be operating in the United States, and one that is devoted exclusively to the Philadelphia area. I was so happy when I discovered there are payphone aficionados who appreciate payphones as much as I do, he said. It used to be you couldn't go anywhere without seeing one. Payphones have been on their way out for decades, ever since cell phones became popular in the 1990s, he noted. A 2021 Pew Research Center study found that 97% of Americans now own a cell phone of some kind. It was 1995, 4 years after Dank was born, when the number of payphones in the United States peaked at 2.6 million. By the end of 2016, there were less than 100,000 still in service, according to the Federal Communications Commission. New York City bid farewell to what some called the city's last payphone this past May, and there were only six payphones said to be working in D.C. in 2021. It's a nostalgic kick for some people to stumble upon a working payphone today, particularly if it's enclosed inside a Superman-style booth, said Dank, adding that the chunky phones supply a lifeline. I've heard about situations of domestic violence where a partner tries to control everything, including cell phone use, he said. There are people who want to get help, but they don't have a way to communicate. Free payphones on the street would help resolve that. If the phone at Iffy Books is widely used, he hopes to place five more around town next year. Each one will cost about $300 to install and retrofit for internet use, he said. Libraries, art spaces, soup kitchens, community centers, I can think of lots of public places that would benefit, Dank said. Carl Anderson, director of Portland's Futel, said Dank is on the right path. Our phones get a lot of use. We even have volunteers now who will answer the phone if somebody dials for an operator, Anderson said. Sometimes people just want to hear a real human voice on the line. He said he is hopeful that Dank's project will become as popular as the free phones in Portland. I'd like to see Philtel succeed. Phones like these would be useful to have anywhere, he said. They're a direct way for anyone to get help, whether they want to find organizations to help with housing and medical service, or they just want to call the mayor, Anderson added. Even if someone just wants to order pizza, Dank said he's good with that. If we can have a payphone from the landfill and trigger some fun memories for people, I'm happy, he said. I hope that bringing back a payphone will help improve somebody's life. So be on the lookout. Payphones may be on their way back. How about that? Well, if you think about it, free payphones would be handy for travelers at times. They could help you find specific locations, and they could be handy if your cell phone battery happens to die. And they just might provide a connection needed during an emergency when there might not be a cell phone available. Our next unusual place of interest is also found in Pennsylvania. As writer Jason Mark of the Philadelphia Inquirer relates to us, a giant three-bedroom shoe is one of Pennsylvania's hottest rentals today. You ready for this one? If sleeping in a 1,400-square-foot work boot is on your 2023 vision board, head west to York County. The Haynes Shoe House, built in 1949 as a marketing tool for a local shoe store, has been spruced up and is available to rent. The home features three bedrooms, 2.5 baths, and a hot tub out back. The shoe's new owners, Naomi and Waylon Brown, bought the property in the summer for $355,000 and set to fixing it up. It opened for rentals on Vrbo, that's VRBO.com, in November. We were the first guests to stay in and test it out, Naomi Brown told the Inquirer on Friday. I celebrated my 40th birthday there with my sisters. And by the way, that would have been Friday, January 13th of this year. The average cost of the Haynes Shoe House, according to Vrbo, is $302 per night. But Brown said the base rate on weekdays is $199 per night. She said the shoe is pretty much booked up through April. As far as I know, there's not too many shoe houses in the country, she said. There may be one in California. The shoe house was built by Malin, the shoe wizard Haynes, on Shoe House Lane, visible from Route 30 east of York. Haynes lived there briefly, but then let people affiliated with his stores or honeymooners stay there. The shoe house was open to renters, then used as a private residence, and for several decades operated as an ice cream parlor. Brown said the ice cream parlor had not been doing well, and with the popularity of short-term rentals, particularly the quirky ones, the conversion back to a home seemed like a no-brainer. The Browns did some modern decorating for the shoe, while maintaining the history and eccentricities Haynes was known for. We've had so many people come here and say, my grandparents stayed here and we wanted to keep this history intact, they said. Brown said the shoe house will be getting a historical marker from the state. So something to look for there in York County, Pennsylvania. Well, lots of fun, lots of things. So our last stop today on Armchair Traveler is the new space age, how to travel space, Earth's hottest new destination. This is done by writer Ben Guarino of the Washington Post, and he sums it up this way. Go boldly, but pack lightly. His article appeared in the January 9th, 2023 issue of the Washington Post. So let's see what he has to tell us. The space just above our planet is booming. Off-world road trips are rapidly increasing. 42 of the 51 commercial astronauts recognized by the Federal Aviation Administration left Earth within the past 2 years. The FAA predicts their ranks will balloon in the next decade, which may also bring new destinations such as a rotating space hotel, whose construction planners claim will begin in 2026. And some experts have expressed optimism that relatively affordable space travel could possibly be possible, by the middle of this century. For now, though, costs remain enormous. A $450,000 ticket reserves a spot on Virgin Galactic's space plane, which flies 50 miles above Earth, six times a passenger plane's cruising altitude. Expect to pay even more to go higher. Blue Origin's 11-minute journey by rocket, which reportedly costs more than $1 million, shoots above the 62-miles-high Kármán line, the generally agreed-upon boundary between Earth and space. Others spend days in space. In September 2024, four civilian Americans orbited for 3 days aboard a SpaceX Dragon capsule. No word on how much it cost them. For $55 million, Axiom Space will send astronauts via a SpaceX rocket to the International Space Station, a laboratory that circles Earth every 90 minutes. For 2 weeks last April, the ISS's first Axiom crew members worked in the lab while foregoing proper showers. The new space age, as humanity looks once again to the heavens. The series examines the recent boom of the private space industry, the long-term ambitions of NASA and foreign space agencies, and the potentially profound implications of this moment for society. Space ought to be on everybody's bucket list, said former NASA astronaut Michael Lopez Alegria, the Axiom Space vice president who commanded the April mission. We'd be the first to admit that it's not quite democratic yet because it's still pretty expensive, but we'll get there. The Houston-based company has already begun to build a segment of what will be a private space station. And here's some tips on how to get ready for space. It says training takes months. Axiom space crew members spend at least 700 hours learning new tasks, how to run experiments, how to dock a vehicle to the ISS, and respond to fires. They also practice on a centrifuge, the rapidly spinning machine that simulates the extreme acceleration of space travel. You don't need to be in tip-top shape. Floating in microgravity is effortless, Lopez Alegria said, but you still have to endure intense G-force as you exit and re-enter the atmosphere. You should be mentally prepared for a unique psychological experience called the overview effect, which occurs when people witness their home planet from above. When we came back from Earth, I could not stop crying, said aerospace PhD student Sarah Sabry, founder of the Deep Space Initiative, who traveled to space last August via Blue Origin, and whose founder, Jeff Bezos, by the way, owns the Washington Post, in which this article first appeared. So, go boldly and pack lightly, because space may be the one place you can fly without packing an ID or passport. When we walk onto the vehicle, we're wearing our spacesuits and pretty much nothing else, Lopez Alegria said. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's, we hope you've enjoyed, version of Armchair Traveler. I'm Mike Edwards, and I hope you'll be joining me next week for another edition. By the way, the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is also available as a podcast at our website. That's ncreadingservice.org. That address again is ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.